I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Every state has a sex offender registry, but Kansas has taken the idea of offender registration to a whole other level, registering more than 20,000 felons for a variety of crimes. We'll start today with a closer look at why the Sunflower State has gone so far and why it's now facing criticism from justice advocates and legislators alike. Then, icebergs in the North Atlantic are nothing new, but in 1856 there were more than usual, and a number of ships and lives were lost. Thomas Nye was the lone survivor of one such shipwreck, outliving 12 other people in a lifeboat adrift at sea. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. A criminal registry is set up to keep track of certain types of criminals. Most people are familiar with sex crime registries. Turns out that Kansas has added a whole series of categories to its registries and turned it into an expansive system that publicly tracks convicted criminals long after they serve their time. The Kansas News Service has looked into this and found that no other state imposes such demanding rules on such a wide range of people. Do the registries improve public safety? That, too, is up in the air. With us to talk about all this, Celia Yopis Jepson is a Kansas News Service reporter who's been covering this issue. She's with me here in the studio. Celia, always good to have you here.
Great to be here.
Wayne Logan is a professor at the Florida State University College of Law and the author of a book on registries, Knowledge as Power, Criminal Registration and Community Notification Laws in America. He joins us from the studios of WFSU in Tallahassee, Florida. Wayne, good morning.
Good morning. Pleasure to be with you.
You know, Wayne, all states are required to have sex offender registries, but do many have other criminal registries like Kansas does?
Well, let me say at the outset, actually, states are technically not required to have registries. They do, but a lot of that is a function of federal influence. So since 1994, Congress has threatened states with loss of federal criminal justice funds if they don't adopt registries and also have community notification available. So in point of fact, all states do have registries and notification now, but it's not because they have to. It's because they've done so.
Gotcha. Okay. And do these other states also have registries that go beyond sex offender registries?
Well, at their incarnation, actually, there was mainly sex offenders, but also people who were convicted of child kidnapping on the reasoning that that people who engage in child kidnapping may be prone to sexually abuse kids as well. So at the outset, there was a little bit broader than convicted sex offenders. But having said that, typically, by and large, states focus on convicted sex offenders. However, convicted sex offender may be defined in the state.
So this notion, like a state like Kansas, Wayne, that's expanded the number of categories as dramatically as Kansas has, we're relatively unique in that arena?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Celia, you found out that Kansas's rules on registries are particularly onerous. I'm wondering how.
Well, so I looked at, there are 19 states that have expanded beyond what the registries were traditionally about, and we looked at the statutes in those states. And what Kansas has is kind of a combination of covering a wide range of crimes. So, you know, someone who's a murderer, someone who shoplifted and then pointed a can of mace at someone, of course, the sex offenders. But then that combined with the rules that are imposed upon these people is unique, we found, across all the states. So
rules like what?
Rules like, regardless of whether you're the one who committed murder or a relatively less serious crime, you have to check in 4 times a year with your local law enforcement. If you make any change to a wide range of personal information in your life, like you decide to get a new email address or a Facebook account, or you dye your hair, or you lose weight, try online dating, a wide range of things that you might do. You got to go back within 3 days in person to let them know. And tripping up on any of some of these rules I'm describing is a felony. So in Kansas, people rack up felonies for violating the registry rules.
Hmm. So just to be clear here, Celia, these registries track convicts even after they've served their time. That's what we're talking about here.
Yeah, we're talking about your registration period is at least 15 years. It can be up to lifetime registration. And that starts after you finish prison, if you went to prison. Now, there are also people who are required to register who never went to prison, who just got, who got probation for a misdemeanor or a lower level felony.
So any sense of why Kansas then is so much tougher, so much more onerous compared to other states? I mean, Wayne just said Kansas is somewhat unique here.
I don't think this is any sort of conscious strategy to outdo other states. To be honest, this is something that's changed in Kansas through many votes by the legislature over the years. I'm not sure that anyone has taken a big picture look at how does Kansas compare to all these other states. But we have gradually expanded, and this is where we are today. And so then it's a question of, are we benefiting our public safety in Kansas, as one side of the debate argues, or as the other side is worried about, are we treating people unfairly who've already served their time?
Yeah. Wayne, so what's your sense here as you look at Kansas's approach to these registries? Does it make sense to you or not?
Well, when you say make sense, I guess it depends on from whose perspective and what the criteria are.
Right.
You know, it's listeners might be interested in knowing kind of the historical trajectory of registries. They actually originated in the 1930s in localities in Southern California that were worried about all criminal offenders, not just sexual offenders, coming in kind of anonymously as a result of increased access to transportation and whatnot. And so those were the first registry laws. And it wasn't until late 1940s that California enacted the first statewide registry law. And that actually, as it happened, focused on sex offenders. So it's interesting to note that, you know, fast forward many decades, we're now Kansas and a few other states are re-examining and expanding the scope of registration, not just to sex offenders, but to criminal offenders of a variety of types. So to answer your question, it kind of really depends on what one considers the goal. In the late 1980s, registration existed, and then in 1990, the state of Washington was the first state to introduce community notification. And so registration, the idea was that law enforcement would know the whereabouts of registrants, and theoretically, the individuals would feel as if they were being surveilled. Community notification, the idea behind that, starting in 1990, was to empower communities with this knowledge. And so the idea was that you would target a particular criminal conviction subpopulation, such as sex offenders, provide the information to communities. Law enforcement already has that information, and that people could take proactive steps to protect themselves. Mm. And this originated in the context of the understanding that sex offenders as a class recidivate at higher rates than other criminal subpopulations. And so, for instance, in 2003, the U.S. Supreme Court characterized sex offender recidivism rates as frightening and high, and that they were dangerous as a class. And we now know that that's not accurate, that sex offenders as a group don't recidivate at higher rates than other criminal conviction subpopulations. And but meanwhile, these other populations aren't being targeted. So in a way, Kansas is kind of stepping back and saying, well, let's use this very flexible technology, which is registration notification, and let's target other populations. I'm not aware of legislative debates or legislative history in Kansas, but I'd be curious to know whether, in fact, a similar concern over recidivism motivated the desire to target violent offenders and drug offenders.
You know, Wayne, if you were advising a state, if they brought you in as a hired gun, as a consultant to talk to them about registries here, would it be your advice that in general these registries do add to public safety, or would you feel differently that maybe they violate the civil liberties of the folks who of convicted folks who are being subjected to these registries?
Well, I mean, I think the first question is really whether they do achieve the public safety goals they set out to achieve. And the literature on that would suggest that no, they don't. And there's also concern that, in fact, they may promote recidivism among individuals because they encourage social instability and lack of access to housing and jobs, which we know.
If these people are targeted so they can't go out and get a job, they can't really do a lot of things that regular members of society can.
Well, I mean, they can, but for instance, if in fact it's made publicly known where a person works, that the employer who decides to employ that individual might be the target of demonstrations and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And that has happened, I don't know, for Kansas for sure, but it's happened in the nation. So the public really and legislators really need to ask whether, in fact, this is the wisest use of limited public safety resources. So for police, theoretically, we have perfect knowledge of where registrants are, but we know that there were shortcomings with respect to the accuracy and timeliness of that information. So that's the Achilles heel. It always has been a registration that if in fact you know where these individuals are, that you can take self-protective measures. But in reality, we know that there are significant difficulties in terms of the accuracy of the data.
Yeah.
You could have theoretically, you could have a much more near-perfect system if you had regular visits by police officers to the homes of registrants. But that's very expensive
right.
when you impose that obligation on already overburdened police forces.
You know, Celia, just to get to Wayne's point here, you write this in your piece, your most recent piece, listing sex offenders on a public registry can make it hard for them to find jobs, homes, and other basic opportunities, as Wayne just said. The more miserable people are, you write, the less they fear doing something that would toss them into prison. Are public policymakers aware of that side of the coin as you talk to them about the pros and cons of these registries?
Yeah, I think that is definitely part of the discussion. So one interesting thing is that the Kansas Sentencing Commission, they're a state agency that's in charge of looking at whether sentencing rules in Kansas make sense. And they're concerned
real concerns here.
Yeah, they're concerned the registry has gone too far and is contributing to prison overcrowding. So one thing that they are asking lawmakers to change right now actually has to do with the drug offenders on the list. There are 4,500 drug offenders on the list. And so these are people who've distributed or manufactured, for example, meth, et cetera. Marijuana is not included in the list. But the Sentencing Commission is basically saying, look, you put people online with their addresses who have manufactured drugs, and you're basically like putting out a Rolodex, out there for someone who's looking, where in my neighborhood? Because remember, this tool has an online mapping tool. I could look at, what's within 3 miles of where I live. Is there someone who's been convicted previously of selling meth? And then I could go knock on their door and check whether I could buy
some. And
what
you found is that indeed has actually happened.
Yeah. So there's a public defender in Topeka who said that this was testimony presented to the legislature, that she has a client who is upset because she's on the registry. She's, worked to change her life. And I guess people have been knocking on her door asking if they can buy drugs from her. So, her address is there. She can't get away from that. So that's one of the arguments that this state agency is concerned mm-hmm. about.
You know, you begin your latest piece by talking about a woman named Tabitha Carter. Is that who you're describing to me right now?
No, Tabitha is...
Tell us her story.
Okay, so Tabitha Carter, the state wants her on the registry for 15 years because she held up a Dollar General in Wichita, took $3,400 from there. Now, at the...
With a taser, I think, right?
Yeah, so... towards the end of the last 30 seconds or so of this robbery, she pulled out an item that the two employees in the store couldn't really tell right then what it was, because I listened to the 911 call. But they, one of them said, well, it looks like maybe it was a taser. So she pulled this thing out and apparently flashed it at them to say I've got this, and then took the money and ran, right? And And it was apparently a taser. Now, they want her on the list under a provision that lets you put people on the list who use deadly weapons while committing a felony. So that's where that, you know, can of mace that I mentioned earlier also came in. So now public defenders are angry because they say that the state is using all sorts of things that are not, by definition, deadly weapons as deadly weapons to add more people to the list. So like a stiletto, someone who hit someone else with a stiletto shoe, or, you know, a BB gun, mace, the taser, that type of thing. So that's playing out in the courts right now. And at the Kansas Court of Appeals, Tabitha Carter won. The Court of Appeals said, like, look, there's a line here. Like, deadly means deadly. Taser's designed not to kill, even if it can in some circumstances. So, like, let's talk about this definition here.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date. We're talking about the proliferation of registries, criminal registries in the state of Kansas that are adding to the burdens of criminals trying to move on with their lives. We're visiting with Celia Yopis Jepson with the Kansas News Service, Wayne Logan, a professor at Florida State University College of Law, an expert in this area. Wayne, have there been legal challenges to registries over the years across the country?
You know, yes, indeed, they have. So actually, in the 1980s, kind of in the early phases before even notification came about, community notification, courts were somewhat receptive to the argument that this was a punishment and it was not fair, either because it was imposed retroactively, which violated the ex post facto clause, or Eighth Amendment even. And then in the early 1990s, as I said before, community notification came, which is a really different experience for registrants because now the whole community knows about it in the world with the internet. Well, so courts, you know, kind of addressed various claims in the 1990s. And in 2003, the U.S. Supreme Court held in a very important case, Smith versus Doe, looked at the Alaska sex offender registration and community notification law, and it held that it wasn't punishment either in terms of intent by the Alaska legislature or the effects that were experienced by the registrants.
It was not punishment, you're
correct.
Saying.
So that means that that determination there has constitutional ramifications for the Eighth Amendment, which bars cruel and unusual punishment, double jeopardy, and the ex post facto clause.
So this ruling was a pro-registry ruling then?
That's exactly right. And so since 2003, jurisdictions have continued to add to the requirements of registration. And interesting recent developments, in 2016, the Kansas Supreme Court and a handful of decisions found the kind of ramped up version in Kansas, ramped up compared to the Alaska version that was before the court in 2003. The Kansas Supreme Court held in a couple of decisions that it was punitive. But by a kind of a simple twist of fate, there's a change in membership on the court. And in a decision, the court reversed itself, in effect, and said it was not punitive for Eighth Amendment purposes. So that really kind of highlights somewhat of the controversy that can exist in courts at times.
Yeah.
The other really important recent development was the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, which has Michigan and among other states. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit struck down Michigan's registration and notification law. One wrinkle in that was that Michigan also had residence restriction laws, which the court thought was important. The state of Michigan then sought certiorari before the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court did not agree to hear the case. And so we can't really infer a position one way or the other. The court didn't approve of the decision. The Sixth Circuit didn't disapprove. It just didn't hear the case. But that's significant because that may indicate a crack in the wall with respect to the federal judiciary in terms of looking at this in a different way than the U.S. Supreme Court did in 2003.
So, Celia, as you look at this issue then, are you finding many members of the legislature who are saying, okay, we've gone too far here based on the court rulings that Wayne just talked about, maybe it's time to gear back a little bit?
So there are two lawmakers I know of who are looking at this a little bit. One is interested in, this is Steve Fitzgerald, a senator, is interested in a small carve-out for a small subset of violent criminals to petition a court to potentially get off the list if they have clean records since their original crime. The other lawmaker is also looking at a very small subset regarding juveniles and whether certain tweaking the law so that certain juveniles wouldn't end up on the list. But we're talking about very, very small changes here.
So, but basically, lawmakers would have to be taking anti-tough-on-crime votes here, and that's always difficult for lawmakers to do if you're talking about this in a purely political sense.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, the testimony when, you know, on one of these bills was, if criminals don't want to end up on this system for years and years and years, then they shouldn't commit their crimes. And I do think that that is that's a sentiment that many of us can easily share. If you don't want to be tracked, you know, why are you doing violent things or selling drugs or committing sex crimes, you know, in the first place?
Right. As you look across the country, Wayne, do you see many states sort of retracting, backing away from heavy requirements on registries and a whole variety of different kinds of registries?
No, and precisely for the reason that was mentioned, it's very difficult politically. I mean, one narrow area is so-called Romeo and Juliet offenses, where you have two young people and engaged in so-called consensual sexual relationships. So Florida, for instance, where I am, kind of unwound it in that regard. But it's interesting to just to reflect upon it, because, you know, I guess back to the question we were discussing earlier, was that what is the purpose of the registries? If recidivism and public safety is the concern, then we really should be focusing on individuals that pose the greatest recidivism risk. And an offense-based scheme such as Kansas has, researchers suggest that that's really not the most accurate way to go about it. It should be much more individually based, on the basis of diagnostic determinations by authorities. And also, just we know that there's the longer a person doesn't recidivate, is the longer they're less likely to recidivate. And so these really long terms of periods of time that are individuals on registries may not be a good use of public resources. And of course, the ultimate tragedy is if we're not focusing on the folks we should be focusing on, and we're distracted by individuals who don't pose a risk, that's a real unfortunate outcome as far as public policy goes.
That's Wayne Logan, again, a professor at the Florida State University College of Law. He's the author of a book on all this, Knowledge is Power, Criminal Registration and Community Notification Laws in America. Wayne, thanks very much.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Celia Yopis-Jepson with the Kansas News Service also joined us. You can see her stories at kcur.org. Celia, always good to have you, too.
Thank you.
Time for a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about a very cold journey on the Atlantic Ocean back in the 1850s that led to a shipwreck and very few survivors. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Before the Kansas City, Missouri City Council put a hold on the vote for a new ordinance to curb panhandling, we were talking about it on this program. You can hear that conversation at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow's program includes a conversation with a sociologist who spent 2 years embedded with successful white families to understand how privileged kids learn about race. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, we're drawn to true life adventure stories and tales of humankind battling the elements on this show. You get all of that and a lot of heartbreak, too, in Brian Murphy's new book that sees its official publication date today. The book, Adrift, A True Story of Tragedy on the Icy Atlantic and the One Who Lived to Tell About It. The book chronicles the story of 22-year-old crewman Thomas Nye, who escapes the sinking of the John Rutledge after it had collided with an iceberg in the North Atlantic. Nye was set adrift in a lifeboat with a dozen others, who then began a perilous journey filled with fights over water and biscuits. One by one, they passed away until only Thomas Nye remained. Brian Murphy is a journalist at the Washington Post. He's a former foreign correspondent and bureau chief for the Associated Press in Europe and the Middle East. One of his previous books is 81 Days Below Zero. Brian, nice to have you. Welcome.
Hi, Steve. I'm a pleasure to be here.
You know, 81 Days Below Zero is also an incredible survival story. Why are you so drawn to them?
You know, I think it's because of the incredible confluence of luck and perseverance and resolve that goes into every survival story. Mm-hmm. And with the book, the previous book you mentioned, and my new one, they're, of course, different settings, different eras, but there is that element of chance, resolve, and a kind of ability not to panic that I think is a common theme in a lot of these survivor stories.
How did you come across this story?
At a exhibit of shipwrecks on Cape Cod, I was browsing through all this very interesting collection of stories from the 19th, 18th, and 17th century. And there was a small mention of the ship, the John Rutledge that you mentioned, and the fact that there was one survivor, which was very unusual at to have any survivors. But during this period, it was very, very rare for a ship to come across a survivor, or let alone come across a wreck. So this was very celebrated at the time. And the survivor, Nye, came from quite a prominent family. So there were a lot of interesting tie-ins to shipping and whaling of that era with the survivor.
You know, you said that you sort of gathered bits and pieces of the story over many months. I gather the story wasn't conveniently housed in just one archive.
I wish it was. No, not really. Like so many of these stories, there was a great repository of log books and various threads to the story across a few museums in New England. Because of two reasons. One, that it was so unusual for a survivor to come ashore from the North Atlantic in that era, and also because his family was very prominent in New Bedford, it got a lot of coverage in the day. So he was a minor celebrity for a month or two, and he, in this kind of spirit of journalism in those days, the stories were much more a exposition by the person. He would just kind of go on and they would transcribe what he said. So there was a very thorough record through the press reports at the time.
You know, you point out that lots of ships sunk in the North Atlantic back in those days, and we're talking about the 1850s here. So why focus on this particular story?
Well, one, because there was a survivor to tell it, but the other one was there was three other ships went down during these months of 1856. And the ice in the North Atlantic, there's an area that's off Newfoundland, south of Greenland, which is still called Ice Alley. This is where the icebergs and drift ice cross the shipping lanes. And this period of 1856 was probably one of the most tragic, at least in these decades in the mid-19th century. And, of course, through the story that I wrote, but also because of these three other ships, it created a kind of tableau of the risks and also how I don't want to use the word ripple in a shipwreck too much, but it's the obvious word. The ripples from the shipwrecks went through business, society, all the way to Ireland, where a lot of the immigrants came from. So it's kind of the story of how these tragedies at sea also played out on land as well.
And why did that happen? Because there was so much cargo loss when a ship like that went down, not to mention the loss of the passengers?
Yeah, both. And as you can imagine, back then, the insurance and all the logistics were all geared to the cargo. So there was this business side of it where cargo was lost, and this played out in New York and Liverpool and the other ports on each side of the Atlantic. But what really struck me was how commonplace these wrecks were at the time. So in the case of the John Rutledge, for example, more than 120 immigrants lost their lives, and it merited barely a mention. I mean, the coverage, of course, was about this one survivor, but the idea of lives lost at sea during that era was such a common occurrence that it even led people to question whether, you know, society had become so callous to it that we were kind of losing a bit of humanity.
Hmm. The ship involved here, again, the John Rutledge, was thought to be a strong ship. Tell us about it.
Okay, this ship was about 5 years old, and it was built as a packet ship. And packet ships in that era were kind of like the workhorses, the shuttles of the day. They the transatlantic ones, for example, would go the New York to Liverpool route back and forth as fast as they could load the cargo and the passengers. This ship was a five-year-old ship built in Baltimore at a very respected shipyard. And, it was as safe as it got for sailing vessels at the time. But, of course, when you encounter an iceberg, it's not a fair fight. The ice is going to win.
But this ship, you point out, had an open hull, if you will. There weren't separate compartments that would avoid catastrophe if there was an iceberg strike, as there was in this case. Do I have that right?
You have it exactly right. And this, again, figures where commerce and expediency create safety problems and possibly lead to death. The European shipmakers at the time were a little ahead of the curve on the Americans. They would put, you can't really call them watertight because they didn't really have the technology then, but water containing or water blocking walls and containments in the hull, which of course, if the part of the ship hit an iceberg, it wouldn't flood the whole hull and bring down the ship. The American shipmakers, because of costs and convenience, were not really doing that at the time. And so a compromised hull anywhere on the ship was pretty much a death sentence for any ship without some way to block the water filling up the hull.
You know, I was struck by this notion that the winter of 1856, when this tragedy occurred, people, the captains and the crew, for that matter, knew that Ice Alley was particularly full of icebergs that winter. So given that, why did the captains risk it and sail in such treacherous waters, or why not veer way south to avoid any possibility of collision? Because as you write in the book, it wasn't, you know, this ship was surrounded by icebergs on the time of the collision.
Yeah, I think, the captains did take that in consideration. And later on that year, the ships were taking a more southerly route. What's hard to kind of get our head around in this age of instant communication is back then it was very difficult to disseminate any kind of reports of ice in the Atlantic, because this was before the transatlantic telegraph. And so reports of ice were carried by captains reaching a port on one or other side of the Atlantic. So when this ship set off in January of 1856 from Liverpool, there were sketchy reports coming in of heavy ice, but the captain didn't have, I think, a full picture. And of course, there were the commercial pressures. As I mentioned, these were packet ships, and the captain's reputations were built on meeting the schedule and getting the cargo to the other side of the Atlantic. So I think there was that pressure as well. So a combination of things, but later on that year, they realized the ice was so bad and captains were charting a more southerly course.
Brian Murphy is my guest. His new book, Adrift, A True Story of Tragedy on the Icy Atlantic and the One Who Lived to Tell About It. How big were some of these icebergs in the North Atlantic that winter?
Really big.
Really big.
Of course, there's the obvious embellishment of reports, but even the icebergs today, they are 300 feet tall. That's probably like the size of a 25 or 30 story building. Huge, wider across, if you classic iceberg shape, pyramid style. So these were, you know, these were massive obstacles to any shipping, and of course they still are today. But when I was researching the book, what seemed to be even more perilous for the captains were these smaller icebergs that they called them growlers, and I'm not quite mm-hmm. sure why, but that was the terminology of the day. And these smaller, faster moving bits of ice that were less obvious, more hidden in the waves, and they packed a punch. They could knock through 6, 7, 8 inches of oak in a hull, and you know, that just shows the amount of power and momentum in this ice.
You know, given all this, maybe this question will sound dumb, but how does a ship manage to hit one of these things if they're so big?
This was a foggy, and again, this is what makes this area called Ice Alley so perilous, because it's also where the currents from the Labrador Sea and the Gulf Stream converge, and this creates really foggy conditions. So you have fog and ice, and of course that lends itself to tragedy, not just with the ship we're talking about, but dozens and dozens and dozens of times over. This ship was in heavy fog, and they hit the icebergs. But once again, it's difficult at night. Back then, there wasn't, you know, they didn't have spotlights or any way to illuminate the course in front of them. So I think that you know, many times it was simply a question of wrong place at the wrong time for a ship, especially at night, and they once the ice ripped the hull, boy, it was very, very rare for a ship to survive.
I love the way you described the moment of impact in the book, Brian, and what it sounded like. You write this: in steerage, it was like the hollow sound of a giant drum roll as the ice gouged through the hole up toward the bow. Even the passengers, I think, instinctively knew that something was wrong.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And what struck me as I researched the book too is, and again, it's resonates even today with people taking great risks to reach this country and others where they try to build a new life. But you know, the immigrants who at this time they were mostly Irish, but from other places as well. They understood the risks, and they would, I mean, there wasn't another option to get across the Atlantic, but they were not all ignorant of what they could face in the Atlantic. So I think as soon as they heard the jolt in the boat, everyone would naturally assume it was ice. So I think they knew, just like the crew and captain did, that they had hours sometimes to mobilize themselves onto lifeboats before the ship's gone down,
yeah,
especially with the open hulls, as you said.
What struck me about these moments after the ship strikes the iceberg is how long it took for word to come down from the captain and the crew that, in fact, yes, we've struck an iceberg, and yes, we're taking on water. I mean, the ship is actually listing before anything official comes down the pike.
Yeah, and this is what in the memoirs and the recollections of Thomas Nye, the survivor, this was a bit of an open question, but the way I sussed it out is, first of all, every captain, I think, is reluctant to declare the ship unsalvageable, even though it was pretty clear at this point. But my reading of this is what they feared most was creating a panic aboard the ship, because this ship, like many others, really didn't have enough lifeboats to handle all the passengers. And I'm sure that this went into the delay and the decision.
There were five lifeboats, I think, right?
That's right. Five lifeboats. In optimal conditions, they could maybe hold 25 or 30 people. There were about 140 plus on the ship. So I guess in theory, they could have held them all, but not in the storm-tossed North Atlantic.
I was going to say, as it turned out, the delay in dealing with the crisis at hand resulted in some people actually being left aboard the John Rutledge when it went down, as opposed to an organized getting people aboard the lifeboats and clearing the ship.
Right. And again, it kind of busts one of the myths of the captain and going down with the ship, for example. In my research, not just with this ship, but with others in this era, there were many times where it was kind of a free-for-all. The crew was pushing aside the passengers to get on lifeboats. The captain left on lifeboat number 4, so there was not he didn't leave at the end, and there were still people boarding the last lifeboat and still on the deck. So this kind of chaos once a ship was going down, I think was pretty common, and that was kind of revelatory for me, and the fact that people were left on board, and it was kind of every man for himself or every man and woman for themselves.
Your protagonist here, 22-year-old Thomas Nye of Massachusetts, how did he find his way to a lifeboat?
Well, he was part of the crew. He was the last lifeboat to leave had several of the crew members, but it also had the wife of the first mate. Mm-hmm. And having spouses for the captain and first mate and others wasn't that unusual. People were out at sea for a long time, so wives often accompanied husbands who were officers on these ships. And the captain had given Nye some brandy and also some other the logbook of the ship, and sent him off on this last lifeboat, thinking that he would be accompanied by the first mate and the wife. The first mate, for reasons that we still don't know, went back up on deck, and he was among these 30 plus people who went down with the ship, and his wife was left on the lifeboat with Thomas Nye, the survivor, and 11 others.
You know, there were just so many moments that just caught me as I read these pages about the John Rutledge and its fate here. You know, there's those sentences you use to describe passengers who need to jump aboard the lifeboats, and the boats, you have to jump 3 feet or so, sort of hang in the air for a second before you would land in a lifeboat, and people hesitating and waiting and not making the leap, thinking the boat might come closer, when in fact the only thing that would happen is the lifeboats slip farther and farther away. And then once in the water, you have a very quick scene of Thomas Nye. They've just gotten away from the Rutledge. The Rutledge is sinking, and he hears the voice from the fourth lifeboat, from the captain, who's calling out, "Hey, who else is out there?" And Nye responds, or people in the boat respond to the captain, but the captain's voice slips away so quickly, and they no longer can hear him. Just the desperation and the panic that must have set in at a moment like that.
Exactly. And, you know, what also was so striking to me is, you know, again, how people's fate can just pivot on that moment of hesitation.
Yes.
Not jumping and saying, well, I'll have another chance in a second, but that second doesn't come. And you know, it's so common in these stories, but this that decisive moment between survival and not.
What in the way of provisions did Nye and a dozen others on the lifeboat have with them?
Not a lot. Had they had some water. They had what they call ship's biscuits, which I guess if people are more familiar with the Civil War era, which is about the same time, it was called hardtack. It was just this hard baked flour and water. And the brandy that the captain had given Thomas Nye in those last moments on the ship. So they had very few provisions, and they were not really good about sharing them. And that's another aspect of this story that struck me, is there was not a lot of collective effort for survival. Mm-hmm. It kind of became a somewhat of a psychodrama on the boat.
And as a result, the boat that Thomas Nye was on only had, would result in only having one survivor. Everybody else would perish. The boat would drift for 9 days. That strikes me as a really long time, Brian.
Yeah. I mean, Thomas Nye, when he was found, we'll never know, of course, but it seemed to me within hours, or at least within a day of death, he was
yes,
in really rough shape. What also sped the deaths of people, besides being exposed and not having the right provisions, is thirst. Thirst drove them to drink seawater.
Yes.
And once that happened, that was a death sentence.
How was he eventually found, drifting by himself at that point on the open Atlantic?
Well, he was, again, as we talked about at the beginning, a huge element of luck. There was a ship bound from France to New York called the Germania, and they had left shortly after the Rutledge left. So this was mid-January of 1856. And once again, the degree of ice that year was not really known to this captain yet. So instead of taking the more southerly route that other ships would take.
I got about 10 seconds here, Brian.
Okay. So anyway, it was a ship that was still in the area and stumbled across him really by pure chance.
Brian Murphy's new book, Adrift, A True Story of Tragedy on the Icy Atlantic and the One Who Lived to Tell About It. It's a heck of a read. Brian, thanks so much for taking some time. I sure appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure, Steve.
Tomorrow on the show, what white kids growing up with privilege in this country learn about race and racism from their parents, their siblings, and their peers. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.